Speak in the name of one God, Father, Son, and Holy Spirit. Please be seated. We're officially in the season after Pentecost. It is the longest running season in the church year. It lasts for about 5 to 5.5 months, depending on the date of Easter. Typically, you know that you're in the season after Pentecost when things are green, but we are white today because a baptism trumps the season after Pentecost. So we are white today for the baptism. Next week, we will be green. You have 5.5 months to enjoy it. So one extra week of white will be a nice break. So you are in the season after Pentecost from the Sunday after Trinity Sunday, which we had last Sunday, all the way through Christ the King Sunday, which is the Sunday before the season of Advent. And the season of Advent is the season that happens right before Christmas. So we will be in this season until it is officially time to watch our Hallmark Christmas movies again. We will spend it in warmth and cold, and then we will eventually get out of this season for the season of Advent. Our readings are based on a 3-year lectionary cycle. We run through most of the Bible in a 3-year period of time. This year we are in Matthew's year. Every year has a different gospel that they follow. We follow Matthew. John is intermittently thrown in between all 3 years. In the season of Easter, which we just got out of, we spent the majority of the season of Easter in John's gospel. But now we are back in Matthew, and we will remain in Matthew for most of the next 5.5 months until we restart the lectionary cycle in Advent 1. So in honor of that, I want to talk about Matthew for a moment. Today we hear Matthew's call story. Matthew is one of the disciples of Jesus. He also has a gospel book that is attributed to him. If you are wondering how the gospel of Matthew starts, it starts with the genealogy of Jesus, all of those names that no one can pronounce, and we just say something and hope that it's somewhat close to being correct for generations and generations and generations and generations. And then we come to Jesus, and then we get to hear the story of Jesus. So we've kind of bypassed all the genealogy of Jesus, but if you love genealogy, you just pull Matthew 1:1 and you let me know how we pronounce those names and we'll go with that. But here we're at Matthew's call story. So this is how Matthew becomes a disciple of Jesus. And there's a lot that happens in this reading. There are like 4 sermons in it. I promise not to give you 4. There are 4 distinct stories. There's the call of Matthew. There's the dinner at Matthew's house with the tax collectors and the sinners. There is the healing of the woman who has hemorrhages for 12 years. And then there's the raising of Jairus' daughter. It's one of the leaders of the synagogues. Jairus is named in one of the other gospel readings. So you have 4 distinct things that happen in this small section of Matthew. So this part of Matthew is really fast and furious. But to focus on Matthew for just a moment, Matthew is a tax collector. We know that because Matthew tells us he's a tax collector. It almost goes with Matthew's name. Every time you see Matthew, it almost always follows, comma, the tax collector. And being a tax collector in Jesus' time, we all know wasn't a great profession to have, but we don't ever really stop to talk about why. So what happened in the Roman Empire, historically speaking, you can read it in history books, the way the Roman Empire worked was they would come, they would conquer a land, they would leave some soldiers there to make sure that that place and territory remained under Roman occupation. But then for the most part, the majority of Romans would leave because they were a massive empire. So the way in which the Roman Empire was able to make the empire work was relying on locals living in the area to collect the taxes to send back to Rome for what they called protection. But it is under an occupation. And to be clear, the people of Israel do not want the Roman protection. They do not call it protection. They are the oppressing force, and they're forced to pay their oppressors an exorbitant tax that the majority of people cannot afford. And Matthew was the person who collected those taxes. But the important thing to note about Matthew is he was a Jew. He was from Israel. He was the people that the Romans were oppressing. And he chose to exploit his own people, to exploit his friends and his family and his parents and his neighbors and his brothers and sisters. He chose to exploit every single one of them for his own gain. Matthew's own gospel does not offer him any sort of protection from the fact that he was a tax collector. It doesn't say Matthew, the tax collector, because he was threatened, or Matthew, the tax collector, because he needed to make ends meet for his family. It just says Matthew, the tax collector. Meaning that Matthew made the choice to exploit his friends and his family of his own free will for his own personal gain. Matthew was not the greatest person in the room. And yet, when Jesus calls him, he's literally sitting in his tax booth. He's literally in the place where he's sinning against people. And Jesus says, come and follow me. And to Matthew's credit, he gets up and he follows Jesus, and he no longer is a tax collector. He never collects taxes again from that moment. But the thing that I love about Matthew's story is that Matthew was a very sinful person who exploited people because he wanted to, for his own personal gain. And yet he was a disciple of Jesus. So when I make a mistake, I feel a little bit better that sometimes, at least I didn't exploit other people, or even if I do accidentally exploit somebody, well, I'm in good company with one of the disciples, so we can also move on with the redemption part of our story. But the story of Matthew also parallels the woman who had suffered hemorrhages for 12 years. Because Matthew was a tax collector, at this point in Matthew's life, he has been disowned by everyone who he had ever known. He has no friends. He has no family. His family has likely disowned him. They're not speaking to him. And he has no one in his corner. He's all by himself through decisions that he has made. And then that parallels the story of the woman with the hemorrhages. Unfortunately for her, this was through things that she did not decide, things that happened to her. But the story of the woman with hemorrhages is that in Jewish ritualistic custom, when a woman is bleeding, they are considered unclean for the entire length of time that they are bleeding and a specific period of time after. And in order to be ritualistically cleaned, they need to be washed in water. And that way they can re-enter the temple. So for 12 years, this woman has been considered unclean. She has not been able to enter the temple. And that's bad enough. But the other part of the Jewish ritualistic custom that this woman is living in is that if anybody touches her, they are considered unclean. If she has any human interaction with somebody, any physical touch, if she brushes past somebody and their shoulders meet, that person is considered unclean for the remainder of the day, and they must be ritualistically cleansed before they can enter the temple. She has no friends, no family, no one in her corner. She is all by herself, and she has been for 12 years. Other gospel readings said that she had spent all that she had trying to be cured, but there was no cure that she could find. And so in other gospel readings, we're told that the crowd is pressing in on Jesus. He's trying to get to Jairus' house to raise his daughter from the dead, and all of a sudden, there's this woman who kind of flings herself through the crowd in order to get to Jesus, and she touches just the fringe of his cloak. And then in the other gospel readings that portray this story, Jesus stops and said, "Who touched me?" And his disciples say, "How can you say, 'Who touched me?' Look at all these people, everybody's touching you." And he repeats the question, "Who touched me?" And she responds that she did. But in Matthew's gospel reading, we're told that she touches Jesus. Jesus turns and says, "Daughter, your faith has made you well." Which is interesting because Jesus's miracles always kind of come in a formulaic response. Somebody comes to Jesus. Jesus says, "Do you want to be made well?" They say yes. Jesus says, "Go, your faith has made you well." The first part of that interaction is missing. He does not ask her, "Do you want to be made well?" He just says, "Daughter, your faith has made you well." She has been unclean for 12 years. She has likely not been called daughter by anybody for 12 years. The first thing that Jesus does is humanize her. And what was interesting is at St. Stephen's, the other church that I work at that has the 9 a.m. service, somebody asked me about the people in the crowd. Would all of those people that she touched to get to Jesus, would they have been considered unclean? And the answer is yes, but also Jesus would have been considered to be unclean. She touched Jesus. In this story, Jesus is considered ritualistically unclean because she touched him. But Jesus doesn't respond to that. He calls her, "Daughter, your faith has made you well." And the part that really stands out to me in her story is that he says, "Your faith has made you well." Not your desperation, not your attempt at something desperate, at all of the things that you've spent money on, not at something else. Your faith has made you well. See, sometimes I struggle because I try and find myself in the story of this of a gospel reading. Where do I fit in? And for me, as much as I love this story of this woman who's called daughter and her faith has made her well, and there's all of these great things that Jesus do, I struggle because I wonder where I fit into this reading. And for me, I'm going to be really honest with you all. I identify a lot with Nicodemus, with the Pharisee who met Jesus in the middle of the night and said, "Jesus, I just want to understand. And Jesus tries to explain it to him. And Nicodemus says, I don't get it, Jesus. And Jesus again tries to explain it to him. And you get the John 3:16 reading out of that Nicodemus story, that for God so loved the world that he gave his only son. And Nicodemus leaves. He does not become a follower of Jesus at that moment. See, I feel for Nicodemus because he has devoted his entire life as a leader of a Pharisee to a specific thought process, to a specific theology and a way of understanding God. And I think to myself, I have devoted my entire life to a specific understanding and theology and understanding about God. Would I really have the faith of this woman to dive through a crowd to touch the cloak of Jesus? Or would I be more like Nicodemus that says, I don't know Jesus, I just don't get it. I'm trying, but I just can't make the pieces fit. We've entered into, like I said, the season of ordinary time. There's a catchphrase that comes with it. It's not mine. It's predated me. I have no idea where it came from. I would give them credit if I did. But the phrase is ordinary time, extraordinary God. That we are in an ordinary time, but God is not ordinary. God is extraordinary. So today we're going to celebrate the baptism of Madeline. And my hope for her, and my hope for all of the children here, and my hope for myself and for every single person here, is that we can be a little bit like Matthew, that we can mess up, we can make some mistakes, we can even grievously sin against people, and we can have the redemption of Matthew, where we are called to be his disciples and chosen people, and we can leave our sinful past behind and turn to God. But then the other part of my prayer for everyone is that we have the faith of this woman. That we have the faith that says, if I just get close enough to Jesus, if I just reach out my hand close enough to the cloak of his garments, I will be made well and whole. I pray that for each of us. And may we remember that in this ordinary season, an ordinary time, we serve an extraordinary God. Amen.